My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. The 1950s saw the UFO field boom as thousands of sightings became recorded. The contactee movement exploded across the world, and from Japan to the USA, Italy to Brazil, encounters seemed to be everywhere. Yet it was the infamous Flatwoods Monster case from 1952 that drew a man into the field who became notorious in certain sections of ufology, and that man was Gray Barker. Joining me to discuss his brilliant autobiography on Barker, The Sorcerian, UFOs, Men in Black, and the Unbelievable Life of Gray Barker, is author, archivist, and librarian, Gabriel McKee. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to James, my latest patron. Your support is greatly appreciated. And to each and every one of you that continue to support the show, thank you as always. You can also click the link in the show notes to join too. Mysteries and Monsters is across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find us at mysteriesandmonsters.com. And our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and the links for that is in the show notes too. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for the artwork, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Gray Barker's legacy still permeates modern ufology, despite his critics' best efforts to erase him from the history, as Gabriel McKee explains next. The early days of ufology can be a baffling myriad of confusion, contactees, and conflicting narratives. One of the key characters in those early days was the infamous Gray Barker, beloved by believers, but despised by many who consider themselves proper ufologists. Barker's influence can still be felt today in ufology, and thankfully, author, librarian, curator, and researcher Gabriel McKee has dragged his legacy back into the light for us all to enjoy. Gabriel, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thanks for having me.
My goodness, I can only imagine, Gabriel, because I know you love your science fiction, but you're not as weird as myself and many people would consider ourselves to be as interested in this topic. Ufology is something I've had a love-hate relationship with for the best part of 40 years. I go through periods where I fall out of it a great deal. Primarily, oddly, due to a lot of the things that are included in your wonderful book, The Sorcerian, which is an incredible overview of one of the sort of arch nemesises of proper ufologists, it would seem, Gray Barker. When you sort of unpeeled the sort of early stages of this, when you were looking at perhaps just creating a bibliography of his books that he published under the Sorcerian label, I believe. Could you imagine the rabbit holes and dead ends and false leads you would end up having to follow down with some hard-worn shoe leather?
Definitely not. This project started as a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet on my computer, where I was going to list the books that had been put out by Sorcerian Books. And I thought, you know, there are probably a dozen or so. Very little did I know that Gray Barker actually published over 200 books, zines, and related things over the course of his 30-plus year career. I did not know when I started that his archive was available to use in the Clarksburg Harrison Public Library. Even when I did find that out, I was like, oh, well, I'll never, you know, go to West Virginia. So that's just going to be, you know, sitting there unused for by me. But then I started to realize, like, some of these books probably only exist, you know, in a few places. And one of those is probably this archive. So the idea of going there just kind of started building up as a compulsion. Because as a bibliographer and a book historian, I believe very much in the materiality of books as an important aspect of them. I didn't want to just describe something based on, you know, oh, I saw an entry in this other bibliography that said this book exists. I need to hold the book. I need to count the pages. I need to see, like, how the ink sits on the page. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really compelling thing. But then as I was there, I'm like, oh, there, you know, most of this is letters. I'll take a look at some of those. And man, the letters that he wrote, the letters that were written to him, the archive has carbons of most of his outgoing correspondence. So you get both, you get really the full conversation. And this picture started to emerge of this, you know, impish character, but also a really, you know, fascinating storyteller, someone who is always presenting himself. He's always kind of curating how he's being viewed. And I just really made me want to, like you said, you know, peeling the onion. It just every level was just more fascinating than the last.
I suppose the thing about Barker is you look at his early life and he's clearly a very intelligent, very switched on, very talented person in a variety of fields. His college days, he seems to have thrown himself into performances and writing, joining clubs. Obviously, there are sort of whispers and rumors about his private life, which I think in the modern era is it's quite obvious that Barker's a gay man in a very difficult period for for members of that community. I also remember reading some rather horrible things that certain members of APRO said about Barker in later years, but I'm sure we'll get to that later. He clearly was a very talented man who loved, it seemed to be, a center of attention without sort of being front and center, if that makes sense. He liked to be involved in things and organizing things, yet he didn't seem to want to hog it all at this particular period of his life.
Yeah. And you can kind of imagine, you know, parallel career tracks that he could have taken, like if he had gone into the movie business or into more mainstream publishing or something. You can see places where he's maybe even given an opportunity to do something else. And yet he sticks with the things that he is known for. Definitely an intelligent and talented writer, mostly an autodidact in a lot of ways in terms of reading, but you know, a voracious reader, as we say. And somebody who didn't necessarily like to be the center of attention. He definitely, and you see it especially in his later writing, views himself as somebody who has a kind of almost unique ability to manipulate events without necessarily being seen. And he's really good at tricking people into adopting his terminology, for example. So, you know, if you ask any of those very serious, you know, the APROs and the NICAPs of the 50s and 60s, you know, has Gray Barker influenced you? And they would say, heck no, he's a hoaxer. We don't like that guy. And yet they are, you know, adopting his terminology. They're investigating Men in Black cases. And so he definitely has a deeper influence than I think can be really easily pointed to.
Do you think he's one of those people that people don't really like shining some attention on from certain sections of modern ufology, I would suspect, Gabriel, because of some of the hijinks, shall we say, that he was involved in? And like you say, even when we speak to the proper researchers, his influence has permeated UFO culture, whether people like it or not, and I'm sure we'll dissect some of that, because I think some people will be very surprised these days when you mention certain terms. Most of it, you can trace the lineage certainly back to him and some of his cohorts at that particular time. He seems to have, people are very happy to push him away, because I kind of came across him in the mid-90s when I kind of fully embraced my Fortianism. Through Keel's work, with the Mothman Prophecies, that was the one where I it was the first time I saw his name, and then I saw a few articles in Fortean Times, There was a documentary I remember in the sort of mid-90s about Barker. And then you kind of lose track of it. And he seemed to have become quite hard to trace down until sort of the last 10, 15 years when more resources have been uploaded and we're getting a better picture of some of these sort of hard to find publications he was involved in that period.
Yeah. I think he definitely is somebody who was a little bit forgotten for a while. You mentioned there have been two documentaries about him. So there's Whispers in Space in the 90s and then Shades of Grey in the late 2000s. First decade of the 2000s, both great for very different reasons, but also I don't want to say frustratingly incomplete, because frustrating implies that, you know, these are movies worth tracking down, but you can only go so deep in an 80 or 90 minute documentary, and so they definitely left me wanting more and seeing lots of missing pieces of the story that I wanted to try to fill in, and that's really what I was looking for in my research. Was to kind of fill in some of those gaps. And yeah, you're right. These are very scarce publications. Some of the early issues of the Saucerian, the ones that I saw in library collections are the only copies I've ever seen. And then some that I found that no one has ever referred to that are in the archive that are things. So there was a publication called the Saucerian Daily, which he sent out to maybe five or six people on a he's using a copying technology. I looked into, the type of printer he was using. The maximum number of copies you could print was 12. So very small edition. So the copies in the archive are probably the only copies that have survived of some of these things. So not only the things that people know about that they couldn't have access to, but some of these kind of more archival treasures that, it's possible some of these letters are, I'm the only one to read them since he received them in, the 60s. And so, the kind of depth there is something that I was hoping to provide with this project.
Well, I think it's quite ironic, because it's one of those it's one of those things that you often find when talking about certain subjects. Here we are on the anniversary of Kenneth Arnold's infamous sighting that starts this whole damn subject in the modern era. June the 24th is when he sees that weird.
I did not even realize that that's what day it was today, but you're absolutely right. Yeah.
and so I think the thing about Barker that always stuck with me is his sort of first raising his head above the parapet in the world of the ufology is one of my personal favorite stories, which is the Flatwoods Monster case.
Yeah.
Primarily because it falls around my birthday when it all kicks off. I love the creature. I love how some people call it Braxy. I've got myself a Flatwoods Monster model. I adore this story. I find it very, I've always found it a very strange one, especially in that pantheon of weird 50s encounters. It's always struck me as a really good one, but it's always been a mess, and you've got to kind of really go back to the initial reports. This is what pulls Barker in originally, because he's sat somewhere in a diner, I believe, and he sees the byline about it, and he thinks, oh, a little bulb clearly goes off in his head, as I refer to. He's shown himself to be a very smooth operator in regards to publicity and selling himself and promotion. A cynic would suggest that his eyes probably lit up, Gabriel, and he thought, aha, now, what can I do here?
Well, I mean, the thing that really grabbed his eye was the byline wasn't just it was West Virginia, yes, but it was his hometown. I mean, he grew up in the towns of Riffle and Exchange, which you can't call towns. They are, a cluster of maybe, five or 10 farmhouses. Sutton was the big city nearby. It was maybe a 5-10 minute drive, and Flatwoods was just as close. And so this was, literally his childhood stomping grounds where this occurred. And so having that kind of synchronistic opportunity, maybe we could call it. It was fate, perhaps, fitting as the name of the magazine where he published that first report, that is where this happened to take place. And yet, if you read his initial report, what's frustrating is that to him, and you can kind of read between the lines and see this, the same day that he arrived to look at the site and talk to witnesses, it was about a week after the monster had been seen. Ivan Sanderson arrived the same day, and he was a big city newspaper writer. So, all the local bigwigs, the mayor, who I think was also editor of one of the newspapers, wanted to talk to the guy from New York and didn't care about the guy who had grown up next door. And so he couldn't actually talk to a lot of the people. He was kind of kicked to the sidelines. And what's also interesting is that then I've been doing a lot of research lately in the archives of Ted Blocher. I think that's how his name is pronounced.
Yes.
From CSI, Civilian Saucer Intelligence, who was another very active person in the early flying saucer world in the 50s. His archive is at the New York Public Library. The Flatwoods Monster case was very interesting to people in CSI and other kind of related groups, but they're all looking at Sanderson's report. They don't really talk so much about Barker's, even though, the first issue of The Saucerian, it's a 20-plus page report. It's very detailed. Even there, he was kind of playing second fiddle a little bit to Sanderson. but I think history has kind of had the better of it, because I think Barker is now much more closely associated with that story than Sanderson is.
Well, absolutely. I think people wouldn't consider Sanderson to be the kind of person to be involved in that. He's primarily, I think, these days, Gabriel, known as one of the leading lights in the early cryptozoology movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so his investigations into hauntings and UFO encounters are often overlooked, I think, because there's always this kind of boxing in of certain individuals in these fields that they only deal with these kind of things. And I think when you look at some of Sanderson's early stuff, when he was chasing down all kinds of things, because all he was interested in was people saw a monster. And whether he wasn't aware that it had come from outer space or not, he didn't really care. He just wanted monsters. And therefore, Braxy fitted into that pantheon of him, because people were describing seeing this 10-foot green and red monster floating about, and nobody knew where it had come from. But yes, like you say, Barker, is West Virginia, has two infamous Fortean stories. Flatwoods is obviously the key one in the 50s, and then the big one is Mothman in the 60s at Point Pleasant. But it is weird how now Barker is more associated with that than the initial person doing all the investigation, who is Sanderson. But it is quite funny when you look at his original report, because nobody was there. Nobody wanted to speak to him. He had to say, oh, do you know such and such? And then they tell him, oh, well, they've told me this. And he was just basically picking bits up of he was on the scraps, really, wasn't he?
Yeah. And then I think he even says, the entire Sunday afternoon he spent, two towns over trying to find something that somebody had said had crashed on a different hill, and it didn't come to anything. So, like, just, it's all frustration. But what's interesting about the Flatwoods Monster is that it's such a hybrid case. Because, like you said, Sanderson was interested in it because it was a monster, but we don't really think of it as a cryptid. It's not something that people have seen, flashes of over the years, and lore has built up. It's a single instance. And yet, the Flatwoods Monster Museum, great place to visit, basing itself a little bit on the Mothman Museum, maybe a more traditional cryptid there. But it's also associated with a UFO. So it's a UFO sighting. Not more so than a cryptid sighting, but it's also somewhere in between. UFO sightings often have little men. This is a 12-foot tall creature, something very different. And the Mothman, too, becomes a kind of hybrid case, because both Keel and Barker are not just talking about the Mothman in their writing on that. They're talking about all manner of other stuff, including UFOs and other things. And so they become kind of hybrid cases, too. So what I've noticed is that, I'm highlighting, Barker's greatest hits, in my kind of standard book talk that I give. And I'm like, oh, well, he's best known for the Flatwoods Monster, which is kind of a UFO case, and the Mothman, which isn't really a UFO case, and the Men in Black, which are associated with UFOs, and the Philadelphia Experiment, which has nothing to do with UFOs. They're all orbiting,
Yes.
They're like all on the fringes and the outskirts, and they're all these kind of hybrid stories that are part of the bigger world of what we call UFOs, but are not quite, they're all approaching it at this kind of sideways angle.
Well, as you mentioned it there, and as I alluded to earlier, the term Men in Black is ingrained in ufology these days. It is one of those cliches that you can, if you look at enough cases, you begin to see them popping up here and there. Even women in black, men and women in black visiting people. You've got these strange cars, you've got these odd people who act oddly. Barker's the guy that really created these characters and these cliches that began to permeate into ufology. And so, as we said, people might want to say he's got no influence in this field. How many people, when you mention Men in Black, people know exactly what you're talking about because of the comics, because of the cliches in ufology, because of the films.
Yeah, definitely. And so he's, of course, building that out of the experiences of Al Bender. And from that, so in They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers, he is telling the Bender story, but he also brings in other stories that he says, you know, are these the same thing? And of course, it's a question because Barker never makes a statement. It's a lot easier if you're doing the hard work of connecting those dots. Then it comes across much more convincing. And I think that's part of his literary art. But if you really look closely at those cases, they're very, very different from Al Bender's. Bender's the only one who sees three people. You know, he's really the only one who is silenced, despite Barker calling these hush-up cases. But, you know, two of the other major cases he talks about in that book are people who continued being active in the flying saucer world for years. And so what he really does in that book is he creates a genre. He says this is a type of narrative that can exist, and it can meet certain criteria. And if it meets enough of them, we can call it this kind of case. So I mentioned in the book, Hillary Evans, in one of his books, has a rundown of, you know, the generic Men in Black case. And he says, you know, there are three men in dark suits. They arrive in a new car that appears an old car that appears new. And, you know, he lists all these things. And then if you look a few paragraphs down, he has a kind of a table of cases, and no case has all of these elements. These are all things that are, it's this kind of chimerical creation from many stories, but then you kind of pick and pin these pieces onto it, and then you have a genre. You have a kind of classic case where really there never was a case like that. And so that's kind of where the influence is for that kind of narrative in particular, is that Barker was the first one to say, you know, here is something, and here is something that we can, you know, consider as being like that. But that is an act of creation that he is doing, you know, kind of literary and folkloric creation.
It's one of those things, because I remember, as I say, back in the 90s, somebody once said to me, if you ever come across a case that involves the two words Gray and Barker, you can take it with a massive pinch of salt. And if you see anything about Men in Black, I won't accept that it's a real story. I'll believe that that story hasn't happened because I know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
They also said very strong things about Charles Berlitz, as we, you know, mentioned the Philadelphia experiment and such like. And he's another similar a kind of character in this genre, as you referred to earlier, that you've got this kind of these wonderful legacies that orbit the world of ufology that everybody's aware about, but nobody wants to talk about them anymore because a lot of people know where they come from and who was involved, and therefore it's it's just we're not going there. And so when you look at where these kind of come from, is it surprising when you see how prevalent the Men in Black mythos still is to this day and age? You can go on YouTube and you will see reports from probably 3 months ago, 6 months ago, of people claiming to have had these encounters, and yet we know the origin story is nonsense.
Well, so what happens is when you have someone who's created this kind of narrative category, this kind of box for stories to fit in, and given it a name or a label, that then becomes something that is a, you know, when you have a bizarre experience that you can't explain, the natural thing that your mind is going to do is look for a category to put it into. What have I read or seen on TV or heard on the radio that is similar to what I've experienced? And so you're giving them a container to put their experiences into. You're giving them a way to categorize what was previously uncategorizable. And so I think what happens with the Men in Black in particular, with lots of things, is that Barker creating that as a story and with a real, you know, it has a narrative arc. So when someone has an experience of some kind that might be similar to it in some way, they can then put it in that box. And then, but then it's going to pick up some of those details from those other stories that are in that same box.
Hmm.
So yeah, that's one of the tricky things. What's interesting though, is that you're right that people should take Gray Barker's stories with a grain of salt. But in a way, he's kind of a scapegoat in a lot of ways, because I think he is not the only one in the world of UFOs who has done the same kind of genre creation and, you know, maybe even manipulation of narratives to fit into the genre that he's creating. What's different is he was he kind of pulled back the curtain a little bit to show people what he was doing and how it was operating. But once you've seen that kind of action in operation, you might be able to start to see signs of it in other people who maybe you thought of as more reliable, you know. But that's kind of dangerous to the world of UFOs, and that's why I think he's kind of been cast out a little bit from the official narrative because of how he showed how some of these things operate in a way that maybe is a little more uncomfortable than just, well, he's the bad guy who makes things up.
Absolutely, and I think every generation has somebody like Gray Barker, Gabriel. Whether they want to admit it or not, as you say, I think sometimes people put their stock in someone so much and then try to ignore the red flags that begin to appear. Because for me, I don't think he was as bad as Berlitz, because Berlitz essentially just made stuff up or deliberately withheld information or didn't include things. I mean, his book on the Bermuda Triangle, which for anybody growing up in the 70s, was like a Bible for weirdness. I think I was about 23 when I systematically started going through these cases, and one by one, they were all nonsense, or his version of events wasn't what happened. And I began to think, is none of it true? Is none of it real? Because the Bermuda Triangle seems to be one of those things, I think, if you grew up in the 60s and 70s, it was the most terrifying place on earth. You then begin to think, hang on a minute, why is everybody going to Florida on holiday if we're going to fly through this thing? Why is there not thousands of holidaymakers missing in a different vortex or wherever we go in this? And then you discover that there's actually far worse places around the world. The Dragon Sea, for prime example, off the coast, south coast of Japan is one where things do really strangely happen. Not necessarily suggesting UFOs, it's more weather and the sea itself. But it is remarkable that Barker seems to be the one that often gets dragged out as the arch hoaxer in ufology, when there are people that have perpetuated far nastier hoaxes and have instigated malicious intent in regards to this particular field, where when I look back at it now, I must admit I've kind of gone through that bit where I just thought, what an idiot. And now I kind of look back with it with my tongue in my cheek, because I can see there's a sense of mischievousness, certainly in some of the early stuff he was up to. And obviously there are certain personal situations he has that he's trying to deal with through the rest of his life, which kind of tainted it a little bit. He seems to get a little nastier as he gets older. But there are some people out there who have done very malicious things in this particular field. Some would suggest even driving people to taking their own lives. Barker just seemed to be having fun and seeing how far he could push things more.
Yeah, I don't really think Barker had much of an agenda. I think he wanted to say entertain is kind of not strong enough, because I think he was really wanted to create experiences for people. And I think it was very playful and very he could get mean-spirited, and some of the things that he did were kind of nasty. He was not particularly nice to his friends after they died in some cases, though I can say a little more on that in a second. But there are people who come along later in the UFO world who do a lot of the same kind of manipulation that he did, who have very sinister agendas in a lot of ways, and have, you know, a lot of places that they want to push things with an end goal in sight. And so a lot of the shift towards right-wing conspiracism that you see in ufology in the 80s and 90s is, you know, using a lot of the tools from Barker's toolbox, but with a different end goal in mind. Mm-hmm. And that is definitely something that is, you know, thing that causes you need to be cautious, I think.
To be fair, it doesn't take you don't have to scratch beneath the surface very far to start finding those kinds of right-leaning conspiracies. The government's kidnapping people, and there's all kind of chip implants, and what are they hiding? And it's all that big government aren't telling us the truth. The military-industrial complex has taken over. All the politicians are puppets, and we're all just the guinea pigs that they're going to test things on. And you can see that, like you say, sort of coming out that late 80s into that 90s period. I know Art Bell often gets hit with the kind of agenda of people saying, well, he helped promote a lot of it. But I don't think he necessarily did, because, I mean, I've listened to a lot of his shows through that period. And if somebody came out with some outright absolute nonsense, he would call them out on it. Mm-hmm. I know I read an article last year where somebody was essentially blaming him for Heaven's Gate and the whole Hal Bopp thing. But I've listened to that interview. Ironically, him and Whitley Strieber, take to task the person that presented the fake photos of the object in the tale, which is what triggers the Heaven's Gate movement. And they call him out. They say, you're a hoaxer, you're a faker, these photos aren't real. And then the guy's going, oh, well, I was just passing them on. And they're like, well, that's not what you told us originally. You said you'd got these photos. And so I think sometimes when it comes to people like Bell and Barker, people like to take piecemeal portions of their life story or the cases that they're involved in, and then don't like to see the end of it, because often it will contradict their preconceived negative opinions of these people.
And on the other side, knowing your history is important. So with Heaven's Gate in particular, they were on a path that they'd been on for a long time. And Barker, in fact, wrote about them in the mid-70s. So that was a group that had existed for a long time. And ever since the death of, I can't remember which was Bo and which was Peep. Ever since half of their leadership died, I think that things were definitely moving in the direction that they ended in by that point. Yes. And on the other end, with government conspiracism in particular, I think what we see emerging in the 80s and 90s is really all growing from a seed that was planted by Donald Kehoe. With his kind of single-minded attention to Air Force conspiracism, and that being the drum that he was beating from the late 40s, and I think that becomes the kind of beginning point for a lot of the broader anti-government conspiracism that we see. The Kennedy assassination is another big part of it, but we don't need to talk about that today.
So I'm going to say we haven't got 4 years, to try and unpick that. But you can. I mean, this is the other thing I think that. Often people look back at the 60s with rose-tinted glasses. It's all about the birth of civil rights movements, the changing of perception, the decriminalization of homosexuality, the cultural movements that happen around the world, fashion, music, art, film. Everybody seems to focus on that. And yet you can look at countries around the world. There's a lot of crap going on. Like you say, you've got the Kennedy assassination, you've got Martin Luther King, you've got Bobby Kennedy's assassination. You've got the problems here in the UK. You've got terrorism on the rise. You've got hijackings happening. There's a lot going on. And so UFOs gets wrapped up in this as another government conspiracy, because when you start to look back, there's things that people are being told by their governments around the world, Gabriel, that are patently false. Vietnam is a prime example. Those kinds of situations with the oil war, the 7 days war, these are all things that have got very strange versions of them, depending when you look at the period of time they happen in. And yet we've got the ability of hindsight now, and we can unpick these and say, no, how did anybody believe this? And so ufology is another layer on this. Whether you believe it or not, some people are absolutely convinced, because as far as they're concerned, they know their government's lying about something. So if they're lying about that, they're clearly lying about this as well. And I think that's what sparks people, because as soon as they realize one thing's not true, well, that's going to be not true, surely.
Yeah, and usually what they're trying to cover up is not what the conspiracy theorists think. There's a lot of things the government doesn't want you to know. It's mostly about, things the CIA was doing in Central America and things like that in this time period. And ufologists don't talk about that too much. It's much more fun to talk about crash saucers and alien bodies. And if that's what is, the stories that are circulating and are maybe even being encouraged to circulate in some cases, well, that's probably not what the actual, hidden truth is in cases like that. So, yeah, it's a mishmash.
I mean, that's the thing about what's going on these days. As soon as they started with this, I was like, right, what's actually happening here? Mm-hmm. And that may make me sound very jaded, Gabriel, but I think because I've seen how it happened in the past, and like you say, it's the look over here mode of government, that now we've got these congressional hearings. I'm like, right, okay, what is actually going on here? What are we not supposed to be focusing on that really matters here? And it's difficult, I think, because that, as you said at the beginning, it's like an onion. Once you start peeling, you just can't stop because it just takes you into places you never thought.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely true. And people will kind of direct you in certain directions. But in terms of the, you know, what's really going on, I think another piece to look at is who is seeking to profit here. and in many cases, it's the people who claim to be, you know, the whistleblowers, and are they, you know, starting organizations and trying to raise money and get defense contracts, and maybe that. I downplay the idea that Barker had profit as his primary motivator, because that's been really the kind of conventional wisdom on him in the UFO world for a long time. I don't think that was the case with him because he lost so much money. I definitely think it's the case with some of the people who are active in UFOs right now, who I don't actually know a ton about, so I maybe shouldn't talk too much. But
I don't think you're far wrong. And we'll leave it there, as I think we deserve. I mean, that's the thing in regards to Barker, as you touched on there. People thought, oh, he was just doing it for money. He went bankrupt in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. He went bankrupt specifically because of UFO book publishing. he had been putting out these hardcover books from 1959 to 1962, and they were expensive, and he didn't really know how to work as a book distributor, and so he had a lot of unsold stock. And then Albert Bender's book, Flying Saucers and the Three Men, the manuscript for that landed on his desk, as he tells the story. There's definitely an open question on the authorship of that I address only insofar as to say we don't know. anyway, he kind of needed to publish that book. Like, no one else, he didn't want anyone else to publish that book. You know, it needed to come from him because this was the story that had been guiding him for nearly a decade at that point. And so he got a loan to get that book published, and it was basically one loan too many. And then on top of that, his arrest, he lost a lot of business. And I found a letter just recently where he's basically saying that a lot of the business he lost was directly because of his arrest, that he was kind of blackballed by some of his clients. And so the kind of 1-2 punch of needing to put out this expensive book and then a real bad financial and legal year for him is what led directly to his bankruptcy. But what's great is he then turned that into an opportunity, because he said, okay, these hardcover books are too expensive. How can I do this cheaper if I don't need to try to sell them to bookstores? And so he starts printing things on office copying equipment. He's not printing 4,000 copies. He's printing 500 because he knows he can sell that many. And so he kind of scales his operations in a way that he can continue operating. But the important thing for him isn't to keep money. It's to keep telling stories and to keep this kind of flame alive.
It is. And I suppose the late 60s, you kind of see a few of them sort of make a bit of a resurgence. I think because of the closure of Blue Book and the fact that most people involved in the subject know the Condon Report's a stitch-up, you know, they were never going to deal with this properly. They'd basically said, well, don't worry, we're going to tell people what you want them to think, rather than actually, well, we're going to deal with this. And then obviously that has ramifications about Hynek leaving all that field. You've got the mysterious death of James McDonald that people don't believe is a suicide because of who he was and what he was. You've got APRO continuing to push forward scientific investigations along with NICAP. You've got Kiel getting involved in this now in the late 60s and obviously being front and centre. Barker dipping his toe into that particular period as well. But then you've also kind of seen that it's like the genie's out the bottle when it comes to UFOs now. The government's trying to sit on it, but you know, the swamp gas story is the straw that breaks the camel's back for a lot of people, and they just go, well, this is just absolute nonsense now. They're just lying to us. So it's almost as if they almost managed to push it back in, and then swamp gas happens and it just goes poof. Nobody's listening to them anymore.
And this is a pattern that you see throughout the history of UFOs. Anytime someone tries to take control of the narrative, you know, it just causes the narrative to grow and mutate in ways that they didn't anticipate. And so as early as the 40s, you know, the Air Force would issue what they, you know, intended to be their final, you know, statement. And then that would include something that then becomes, you know, the next phase of the mystery. So for someone like Barker, he doesn't want the mystery to end. He doesn't want a solution to the flying saucer mystery, because then that's the end. There's nothing more to say at that point. Mm-hmm. And so the year after the Condon Committee report came out was Barker's busiest year as a publisher. He put out more books that year than any other. And so that's really the time when he needs to kind of buckle down and get the narratives out there. And so it becomes an opportunity then for new mutations to the kind of organism of UFO narratives.
Mm. There was one incident that really made me raise my eyebrows. Was this letter that him and Mosley falsified and sent to Adamski, which really made me chuckle,
yeah.
I have to say, Gabriel. And that's quite early on when he's sort of been in this field for, what, 4 or 5 years? I think it's towards the end of the 50s. But the biggest mystery seems to be where on earth they got this official headed paper from, because nobody seems to know where that appeared from.
So I address this in the book a bit. There is evidence in the archive that the letters came from a teenage flying saucer fan who was the child of a U.S. diplomat in the State Department. Mm-hmm. And there are letters back and forth between this person and Barker talking about stationery, windfall in one point, and Barker says, we're not going to use this for anything sinister, just to hush some people up. And so it is. The answer to that is known. I have decided not to use the name of this individual who provided it. They were a minor at the time. I think the investigation ultimately into Barker, because he was identified very early on. In fact, within weeks of the first letters going out, some of the recipients of them had said, oh, this is Barker and Mosley. That's next time. Closure archive. The CSI was one of the targets of one of the other hoax letters they sent out at the same time, and they instantly knew who had done this. And there were detailed letters sent to the State Department saying, you know, Gray Barker did this. That's available in the FOIA release documents from the State Department. You can find that. But it was ultimately dropped, I think, because it was going to be an embarrassment to the State Department and was possibly going to, you know, mess up this young person's future prospects. And so I think that diplomat may have, pulled a string and said, let's just let this one go. Like, nothing really bad happened here. You know, this is not necessarily a good use of government resources to track this down any further. Mm-hmm. So I have not used that person's name. That person's name is out there in other publications, but I refrain from naming them.
It is surprising. I suppose the other aspects of all this is Adamski's probably one of the most famous contactees from that particular period. Because the thing that's always interested me about this particular era is the change from contactee to abductee. And it's weird how when I've heard people talk about this particular change in the field, or even in this day and age, people don't really listen to anything contactees have to say. They all think it's all fantasy and delusion. And there's several well-reported cases from the 50s and 60s about cognitive dissonance being created through a UFO cult. As we've touched on earlier in regards to the path that Heaven's Gate were on, they were already on that path in the 70s. You know, regardless of what happened 25 years later, Applewhite was taken in one way, and whatever happened, they were going to get there, sadly. When you look at that, is it interesting to see how abductees seem to be put on a pedestal more than contactees? Because you look at sort of the Hills at the beginning of the 60s and other famous cases throughout that period into the 70s as well and 80s. They seem to be treated not necessarily fairly, because I think people who are skeptically minded think they're all talking nonsense. Whereas I think certain UFO research organisations and ufologists will look at an abductee far more seriously than somebody claiming to be getting messages from their friends at Venus.
Yeah, this is a really interesting distinction, and the way that the earliest abduction narratives in the 60s and 70s kind of get received, it's very interesting to look at. So contactees were rejected by people, you know, like your APROs and your NICAPs pretty much immediately. And I think the reason is because, you know, these stories aren't strange enough. These aren't alien enough. This doesn't seem like something that, you know, if there were actual aliens, they're going to be more different from us than this. And so what happens with the earlier with the early abduction narratives is they kind of get adopted by the more serious side of ufology in a way that contactees were not, because these stories finally seem strange enough. Mm. But this is the result of a process that happens throughout the 50s and into the 60s that I think Barker is a very big part of, where there's kind of been a tolerance built up to UFO sightings. You know, I saw a light in the sky and didn't know what it was, is a really boring story by the late 50s. Yes. It's not going to like get people reading your zine if that's the kind of story you're reporting. And so there becomes this kind of appetite for things that are weirder, and that just grows and grows and really reaches a boiling point by the kind of late 60s, mid 70s. What's interesting, I think, is the term that you see a lot of shifts in meaning in UFO terminology. And so one thing that I like to highlight is the term high strangeness, mm-hmm. which we use a lot now, right?
Yes.
To refer to all manner of weird things. That has a very narrow definition when it's first introduced. It's introduced by Hynek to mean, yes, specifically, how weird is the light you saw in the sky moving? Is it, you know, is it stranger than an airplane? Is it, you know, could an airplane not do this? It refers really narrowly to, you know, the motion of an object in the sky, but then it gets expanded to mean all kinds of other stuff. So the abduction stories that start to come out then have enough, they seem alien enough, they seem weird enough. But what's particularly interesting is that Barker in particular, and Mosley as well, look at these abduction stories as just another flavor of contactee. And Barker writes what I think is maybe his most skeptical piece of writing, in the, you know, traditional, you know, Phil Klass style skeptical, about the Travis Walton case. He says this is just another, you know, we've been reporting on these stories for 20 years, and this is a, you know, not a particularly interesting one, is basically his take. Jim Mosley into the 80s and 90s, I think, was referring to Betty Hill as a contactee. But another piece of this is that if you really look at, you know, what is the real difference between an abductee and a contactee? You know, contactee says, you know, I met friendly space people. They gave me a message about, you know, nuclear weapons or the environment, and said that I need to spread this message to the people. Well, that's, you know, Betty Hill did that. Whitley Strieber did that. Betty Andreasen, I think, did that. So some of the real classic abduction cases end up going in the same direction that the contactee cases did, even to the point of people, you know, founding organizations, you know, to spread their message. And so, you know, the fruits of that tree are not really as distinguishable as maybe we would like them to be. And so it is, I kind of am with Barker a little bit that, you know, I think abductees are contactees of a kind.
It is strange because, like, I mean, this is the thing that often gets overlooked about the whole Mothman case is Indrid Cold, mm-hmm. and his encounter with Willy Derringer is essentially a contactee experience.
Yeah, it's 100% a genre standard contactee of the 50s. He's just very late for it. he's just late to the party. Yeah. And that's why it's so strange to me when people present Indrid Cold as something stranger, because to me there is very little difference between Indrid Cold and Orthon. So yeah, it is essentially the same. And Barker and Keel, I think, in the moment, we're looking at it the same way.
Mm. Because it's one of those, because the whole experience is very similar. It's all about being whisked somewhere and see, you know, I've been taken on this trip and they've told me this and whatever. And then I think Keel get calls from somebody claiming to be Indrid Cold. But it's one of those that he wasn't really, they weren't sure who was doing it. And you would imagine when this is all going off, somebody somewhere has gone, I think I'll just call John Keel here and pretend I'm this person.
I think it goes deeper than that. I had a long section in the first draft of this book, too long, where I dug very deep into John Keel's research notes from 1966 and 1967, which are available. Doug Skinner, who has Keel's archive and maintains it, has been digitizing material for it and uploading it to johnkeel.com. And you can read day to day what Keel was going through in this period. And yeah, it's a very long and involved story that involves a woman named Jay Perro from Long Island. He records every strange phone call he got. So, you know, you read that chapter in the Mothman Prophecies where he's talking about phone interference. This is the period that he's talking about, and you can get it day by day, as well as, you know, handwritten notes he's received and phone conversations he's had with people who claim to be space people. And you really see him spiral, I think, over the course of this, where he begins with a very, like, these are just my notes for the day, kind of skeptical. And in the end, he is convinced that someone has predicted the assassination of the Pope, and this is, you know, related to, you know, the impending apocalypse. And he has really fallen into the Chapel Perilous here. And it was, I think he was on the edge for a little while of you know, something very mentally dangerous for himself. And I believe that a significant portion of this was prank calls that he was getting from Gray Barker and Jim Moseley. I can't establish it 100%, but there are some suggestive hints. There is a handwritten note that is scanned from Apple. A-P-O-L is one of the spellings given of that, who is one of the Men in Black / space people that Keel was relating stories about. And I squinted at that letter for about 45 minutes one day, trying to figure out if it was Gray Barker disguising his handwriting. And I don't know is the best I can say. I think it might have been, but I can't be sure. And particularly because in some of his other hoaxes, he didn't bother trying to disguise his handwriting. So I'm not sure. Maybe he had learned his lesson by then. But certainly a lot of the phone interference and things, you know, was all prank calls from Barker and Moseley. And the scariest chapter for me in the Mothman Prophecies is that strange phone call from Gray Barker, which you know, becomes the chapstick scene in the movie, and is, you know, he's saying, well, this sounds like Gray Barker, but it can't really be him. He sounds kind of robotic and doesn't know information that Gray would know. And Keel, you know, calls Barker up and says, you know, why did you make that weird phone call to me? And Barker says, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't call you. And then writes him a letter a few days later saying, you know, it's the weirdest thing. I have no memory of calling you, but I looked at my phone bill and there's a call. This is a weird mystery. Maybe you can figure this out. He creates a mystery for Keel he creates a rabbit hole for Keel to fall into. And but Keel's notes on this call from the day that he received it call it the Gray Barker hoax. And you know, refer to it just as a dumb prank that Gray Barker had played on him. So he knew right away what had happened. He just Barker convinced him, or he convinced himself that it was maybe something strange and mysterious. And then by the time you get to the point of him writing the Mothman Prophecies, it's the scariest thing in the book. So yeah, it's a really interesting process that it went through.
I suppose one of the strangest aspects of all this is obviously people refer to Barker's drinking. Would you suggest that he was a functioning alcoholic that occasionally had blackouts and couldn't remember what he'd done? Or would you just say, because of his repressed homosexuality, as I touched on earlier on, Carol Lorenzen of APRO said she didn't like him because he wore too much lipstick, but she was a renowned homophobic bigot, as came out in later years. She wasn't a very nice person, regardless of her interest in this particular subject. I don't care what anybody says. Do you think he was dealing with that on top of the normal strains and stripes of being a closeted homosexual in 1960s America who also happened to specialize in weirdness?
So there are a couple questions there. So to the first one, was he a functioning alcoholic? I think probably. I think within the last few years of his life, I think alcohol was definitely a big contributor to his health problems. In terms of his sexuality, I am not so sure that he was as closeted as we often assume. I think he was, there were certainly people in the UFO world that he was out to, you know, by choice. I think there were other people who knew. So Cora Lorenzen, who he was not friends with, obviously knew. So I think I maybe it was more of an open secret in a lot of ways. And one thing that I kind of learned in going through his archive and in researching just kind of queer history in general is the extent to which there really is a kind of tapestry of gay life in rural areas and small towns that we don't necessarily expect to see from our kind of, you know, with our assumptions of the 21st century and, you know, our ideas about urban and rural life. And so I'm not 100% convinced that he was closeted, you know, as fully as we tend to assume. But certainly it was there were difficulties to being gay in Clarksburg in the 60s and 70s. You know, his prosecution is only a part of it. There's one case where he, in an issue of the Saucer News non-scheduled newsletter, described someone coming to his apartment and damaging his printing press. I'm fairly convinced this was either a gay bashing incident or someone who he thought might be interested in being a sexual partner who wasn't and took it out on him and his property.
Yeah.
So it does kind of get incorporated into his narratives to a certain extent. There is, so in I think both of the documentaries about Gray Barker, Jim Moseley proposes the theory, which he kind of presents as a fact, I think by the later one, that Gray Barker died of AIDS. And this has also kind of become received wisdom in a lot of ways. I actually have come to doubt that. I think it was more the result of being an alcoholic and a lifelong smoker, that, you know, this was hard living. And those, I think, ultimately took their toll on him. And based on his death certificate, which I've seen with conversations with his relatives who were kind of there and clearing up his estate in the immediate aftermath of his death, that I think it was a little more of the kind of environmental results of smoking and drinking was really the true cause of his death. But I do, as I say in the book, it is fitting that his death has become a mystery, even if a small one.
Yeah.
That we don't actually know.
Yeah, I think it is one of those things. I think because of when he died, which is 1984, people have just said, "Oh, well, he must have had HIV then. He must have." And I think that's a bit of a leap, isn't it?
There is. And one thing, the kind of deciding factor for me is that when I learned that he died in the Charleston, West Virginia hospital, which had an AIDS ward in 1984. So the assumption is kind of like, oh, well, you know, it wasn't the big city, so nobody knew about this, is false. This was something that was nationally known. There were, you know, national health reports on HIV. As early as I think 81 or 82.
Yes.
And so this was, you know, the average person on the street might not know it, but the doctor in the Charleston hospital certainly did. So yeah, I think that is another piece of evidence that we may, or non-evidence maybe, that we should keep in mind.
Yeah. I think it's remarkable that people ignore the fact that he was like a heavy smoker and an incredibly heavy drinker.
Yeah.
And 59 years old, 40 odd years ago, when you've got those kinds of lifestyle choices, is gonna get you. Even these days, you know, nowhere near as many people smoke, and they're a lot safer. The ingredients are there. I mean, it's still something that's gonna help end your life.
Yeah.
But you know, we're talking a period where most cigarettes didn't even have filters on half the time. You know, you'd be necking bottles of whiskey a day. This was not a good way to live your life, and I think that's clearly more of it. And I mean, it's kind of tied into this whole him being very comfortable in his skin, despite being a small town man, really, that Moseley's often said that he hated traveling. He didn't want to go anywhere. He loved his hometown, despite the challenges it would often bring forth for him. And so you would suggest that if he was that desperate to embrace that kind of lifestyle, he would surely have gravitated to somewhere like New York or San Francisco, and yet he was very happy, regardless of the challenges, as I say, that it would have brought him, to stay where he grew up. That's where he felt most comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. And what I say in the book is that what Jim Moseley is kind of manifesting when he says that is something that was the term for that was coined by a queer theorist named Jack Halberstam, is metronormativity. The idea that, you know, gay culture is in the city and the rural life, the country is the closet. And it kind of equates, being, in your small town or in the country as being closeted and as, not being free to be who you are. But this is the result of the great gay migration narrative, which emerges in the 70s, of yes. where there were a lot of people who moved to the yes. cities and came out there and found a community. But they're the ones telling the story. What they're not telling the story of is the people who didn't make that move. And so that's why I talk about this tapestry of gay life. I found letters to from Barker to other gay people in West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania. So there was a community there. And as there is now, queer people are everywhere, and we're in the 60s as well, and so that's the piece that I think Moseley is missing. He said elsewhere, I think that he didn't think Barker had any friends in Clarksburg. I don't think that was true. I think he did have friends and associates. Moseley didn't know them because maybe Barker liked spending time with Moseley a lot more, and didn't want to hang out with his local friends when Moseley came to town. So that is, I think, another piece.
Yeah, well, everybody says Moseley's damn good company when people had the opportunity to spend time with him. Everybody said he was the life and soul of the party, and he could regale you with amazing stories all night, and he would just carry on getting tanked.
Yeah. Maybe he'll hoax a letter with you if you get him drunk enough.
I mean, obviously, it kind of drifts into the 70s. Sort of the last sort of 15 years of his life. And you can kind of see the beginning of a change, really, in how sort of up front and center he was. Do you think that's because he realized perhaps that a lot of the organizations and investigators weren't necessarily fed up with him, but they'd kind of cottoned on to him having his finger in certain pies, and therefore they just wouldn't give them the time of day that perhaps they would have done in the early and mid 60s.
And I think to a certain extent, he felt that the world of ufology had moved on from him in a lot of ways. But part of that is his mailing list. So he had built his mailing list up in the 50s. He had assembled it from a few different sources. And it was largely made up of the audience for contactee literature in the 50s. And this is something that I actually want to do more research on. I want to know more about who was reading these books, but I've kind of come up with this half-baked maybe theory, because this is just within the last couple weeks that I've started really thinking about this, of kind of the contactee housewife, that there were in the 50s a lot of people who were a little older, more female than male, who were interested in the stories of people like George Adamski. And I think this was kind of the bread and butter for Barker's business. It's interesting, in particular, because we think of ufology as being a very, young white male pursuit. And so the fact that I think Barker's audience was more female and older is a really interesting data point that I want to explore a little more. So, but by the late 70s and early 80s, a lot of his readers had died because they were already older in the 50s. And so this was, and he didn't really have a great way to build it back up. And so he complained a little to Tim Beckley. He was writing for these kind of national UFO magazines that started emerging in the 70s that Tim Beckley worked as kind of an agent for. So Barker had a number of articles in them, and he was complaining he wasn't really seeing any business bump from these. He'd get his money for the article, but he was really hoping he would sell more books through them, and that wasn't really happening. So, but what you see in the last few years of his life is his publishing output really increases in the early 80s. He starts putting out more titles, but a lot fewer copies of them. So he's goes back to printing things in his home. His nephews are his press operators in this period. And this is where you start seeing those comb-bound books that you maybe have seen pictures of, or if you're lucky enough, you may have a couple. They're very hard to track down in a lot of cases. But they're really cheaply produced. But he describes the process of producing them as this kind of artisanal process of like handcrafting each copy. So he's putting a lot of kind of love and care into these janky looking little photocopied books that he's issuing. And so the edition size, you know, was 4,000 or 5,000 for his books in the early 50s, is now down by the 80s to the dozens probably. And so certainly a decline in the number of books that he's shipping, if not the number of titles that he's actually publishing.
Yeah, it's almost as if he passes away probably 10 years too soon, because it would have been very interesting to see how he would have been viewed in the next UFO boom of the late 80s, early 90s, Gabriel, because he's one of those characters, I think, that passed away, because you look at some of the people who get mentioned in the contactee movement. Dorothy Martin, who I touched on earlier on about cognitive dissonance and the prophecy that doesn't work, thankfully, because we've prayed enough to stop the aliens blowing us up now. Okay, she lived until the 90s, which is remarkable, really. And like you said about the housewife contactee fan base, that's what she was. She was a suburban Chicago housewife who ended up with a UFO cult working out of her front room. There were hundreds of these people wandering around America in the 50s, it seems. And so he just seems to have passed away. If he'd have lived into the early 90s, I'm sure, very similar to what happened with Kiel, because Kiel kind of drops off the scene really in the 70s and 80s and becomes more of a niche author and researcher. By the time the 90s come back around, Kiel's front and center again, and everybody's holding up the Mothman prophecies as one of the Bibles of strangeness.
Yeah, and I think you see something a little similar with, particularly by the time The X-Files is on the air, I think Mulder and Scully are referred to as Men in Black at least once in the course of that series.
Yes.
And I think you do see a little bit more love for They Knew Too Much in particular in the 90s. So yeah, I think if he had lived a little longer, then maybe he would have gotten to see some of that, and who knows what he would have been able to contribute to it.
Do you feel that this book has given a more rounded, less biased overview of his life? Because when I read it, I have to say, I've already kind of gone through that transformation in regards to how I feel in regards to Barker. Now I don't mind him. I think he was quite a cheeky trickster. But like you say, I think due to his drinking in later years, he could be quite poisonous in regards to if things didn't go his way. Do you think that it's enabling a sort of renaissance in how we look at him rather than people just dismissing him completely? Because he is vitally important in ufology, whether people like it or not.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I wanted to give a really rounded picture of him and of his complete life. And so I wanted to dig deeper into the aspects of his life that are known about but aren't necessarily looked into too much. So like his work in motion picture exhibition is something that I dug into a bit, which is something that's always talked about, but nobody has really teased it out too much. His sexuality similarly is you know, I wanted to be more than a footnote. Mm-hmm. And so really what I wanted to explore and what I kind of came to as a way of understanding him is to look at him as a storyteller, which I think is really how he fundamentally saw himself. And okay, if he's a storyteller, what can we learn about the way that he tells stories and the way that storytelling functions narrowly within this world of UFO literature? I hope that this gives both a rounded picture of him as well as a kind of maybe more theoretical look at how stories function in the world of UFO exploration.
I think you also have to take into consideration the books that he published under the Sorcerian label are incredible bodies of work in regard, whether you believe them or not, I don't think's the point. I think they just encapsulate that whole period so well. And I think because some of them are so rare, I'm trying to think, which is it? Menger?
Howard Menger, yeah.
I saw one of his books, I don't know, about 6 months on eBay, a tatty secondhand. Well, it wasn't tatty, but it was well read. And the starting price here was £800.
That's overpriced for that book, but I've done my. I can tell you what a Saussurean book is worth, and that's too much for that one.
Yeah, I mean, there are as with anything, Gabriel, there are some gems hidden in the dirt in some of the work he published. Do you think that they need reevaluating as a cultural touch point in regards to that period, rather than a believable story of people having friends from Venus?
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that I kind of realized as I was going through this is, you know, I was looking at Saussurean books as for a while, this was a bibliography. Then I was kind of thinking of it as a corporate biography, a biography of Saussurean books as a company. Then I kind of came to realize there is enough in the archive to make it about him personally. But the books were always the starting point for me. But I realized that, like, the books themselves weren't that influential individually. That there were a couple books that people will cite and refer to, but for the most part, these were books that didn't have a very far reach in the UFO world. And I think that's kind of disappointing in a way, because a lot of them are really fascinating reading, and not necessarily for the reasons you'd think. And one of the ones that I always cite is The People of Planet Clarion by Truman Bethurum. So not his best known book. This is a later publication, edited by Tim Beckley, this one. It is about 100 pages of this man who worked as a highway construction worker talking about his life growing up in the final days of the Old West, and the parties he used to go to and the mischief he used to get up to as a teenager. And this is fascinating reading, because what other 1950s highway construction worker can you think of who has written a memoir? I can't name one. And so this is really a snapshot of a life that we otherwise wouldn't have. The book gets real boring once he starts talking about the aliens. But these people and these personalities are what's really fascinating. And you get a really good picture of kind of the inner life of a lot of these really unique people that wrote some of these books. And so, yes, I definitely think they're worth reevaluating. I don't think the answer to the UFO mystery is in there. I do think they're worth a look for the history, not just of UFO culture, but of, you know, American culture, you know, human culture.
I suppose as well, before we wrap up, Gabriel, I mean, the fact that he's got an archive in Clarksburg surely speaks volumes about his reputation and his reach still in this day and age, because at the end of the day, they don't need to do that. They could just be locked away in a room somewhere, I'm sure. But obviously, it's...
Or tossed in a dumpster, which, you know, is what happens to most people's papers.
Precisely. I'm trying to think, the Pascagoula case. Friend of mine has done a lot of work in regards to that, Philip Mantle, and someone got in touch with him and said, oh, we've got all these boxes of documents in his garage, and it was all these official reports and investigations into the case, and they'd just been left in a garage in a house of the person who was involved who had sold it, and they just left them there.
Wow.
And so I'm glad something like that didn't happen to Barker, regardless of what people may think of him and the work he did, because his legacy is there for all to see every time anybody uses the term Men in Black on its own, yeah. Even.
Yeah, my previous job, I worked for a company that did archives processing, and we would recover the archives of mostly, you know, kind of post-war counterculture artists from the 60s, 70s. And in many cases, the reason that we would be getting these archives is because the artist or author had a storage unit that they could no longer afford the rent on. And the alternative was this stuff gets thrown in the trash. And this is, you know, our cultural legacy of this period of American history. And so our mission was to kind of like save history from being tossed out. And I'm really glad that Barker's archive was preserved. I think it was very forward looking of the Waldemar is the local history center there that acquired the papers, that they, you know, made a home for that, and have kept it accessible, and made this book possible, and who knows how many more, in the future.
Absolutely. I suppose has this, this mad journey into this period of ufology, has it given you a taste for any of the other characters in Barker's life to to track them down, and because I'm, you know, Barker's the tip of the iceberg. There are so many weird people in this period,
yeah,
just doing stuff. I, you know, as I mentioned, Berlitz is a prime example, and the things he was involved. I mean, the Philadelphia experiment. If you know enough about ufology, you can follow it to when it starts, and you know that none of that's true. And yet, here we are in 2025. I know people who think that's real,
mm-hmm,
still, and I can't get my head around it, because you go, well, this is where it started, and they'll go, ah, and they come out with the typical, that's what they want you to think.
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of characters in this book that you know, deserve more exploration. I mentioned Ted Blocher, who similarly, his archive has been preserved.
Oh,
he's a really interesting character, because not only was he active very early on in, you know, flying saucer groups in New York, he was also gay and was active in the New York gay community. He was a member of the Gay Men's Chorus for a number of years. So he's another very interesting character. He's kind of, but his legacy is kind of bifurcated. People know, UFO people know about his UFO stuff, and I feel like there's probably theater people who know about his theater stuff.
Yes.
But I don't know that the whole picture has ever been painted. Gray Barker's longtime partner, Don Lee McCulty, is another character. If you've seen Whispers from Space, he's interviewed in that. He is,
yes,
a character. He was the president of the Vivian Leigh fan club for a number of years. And he's one of the reasons that I say that I don't know how closeted Barker was, because
yes,
they lived together. And nobody, it was no secret to anybody that Don McCulty was gay. And so I think this was, it was kind of known. And then on the kind of more paranormal UFO side, T. Lobsang Rampa, the self-identified Tibetan Lama, who was learned was maybe in fact a British guy who had never left the country. He is a fascinating character that I would like to study more. And then one of the lesser known ones, John W. Dean, who wrote two UFO books, Flying Saucers and the Scriptures, and then his Saucerian one was Flying Saucers Close Up. Is a person who I've long been interested in. His book is, for Saucerian, is their kind of most deluxe production, has lots of color illustrations. And throughout it, he is rambling in a lot of ways. The book is really poorly organized. You get snippets of his life here and there throughout. He was a school teacher. He wanted to serve in World War I, but couldn't because of an injury, and blamed the U.S. government for many of his sufferings. And then in his letters to Barker, you get this kind of very sad picture of the last few months of his life. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a tragedy, but I kind of want to know more about him and tell his story a little more. I get into a little bit in the book, but I did have to keep things to a reasonable length, so I had to cut a lot of that section, unfortunately.
Well, Gabriel, as I said at the beginning, it's an incredible book. I think anybody who's interested in ufology, regardless of what they think about Gray Barker, has to own this book, because it's wonderful. It's, as I said, it's brilliantly researched. It's funny. It's incredibly strange. There are things that happen in it that make you scratch your head and think, how did anybody swallow this? It is a fantastic read from start to finish. And I really hope that you do dive into more of these very weird characters in this particular scene, because books like this, I think, are vitally important to preserve the history of some of these characters and what they got up to in that period, which for many of us is like another lifetime ago for this. You know, we're talking three generations ago now.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And yeah, this is definitely something where I saw a gap that needed to be filled with this book. I kept waiting for somebody to beat me to the punch and publish a biography, and fortunately no one did, or I don't know if fortunately is the word, but I made it first.
Yes, I'm sure Gray would be very proud of you for spotting that opportunity and running with it.
I hope so.
Yeah. So, Gabriel, where can everybody get a copy of this book, follow your work, and keep up to date with what else you've got planned, sir?
Yes, so the book is The Saucerian, UFOs, Men in Black, and the Unbelievable Life of Gray Barker. It's out now from MIT Press. And you can find me online at GabrielMcKee.com. I'm on Instagram and Blue Sky as well. If you have a copy of the book already, I would greatly appreciate it if you write a review. Goodreads, Amazon, wherever you do book reviews, that would be great.
Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you for joining me, and I hope we get an opportunity to speak again in future. Thank you for your time, sir.
Yeah, and thanks for having me.